I'm going to be talking about New York's HIV, ending New York's HIV epidemic, the policy changes and the impact on the STD clinics. Okay, let's just enter. I'm going to really go very quickly through the science, the policy, and talk about the impact of that policy in terms of program, specifically the transformation of New York City's STD clinics into destination clinics and hubs for sexual health care, as well as some of our next steps. Quick look, HIV cases in New York City on an annual basis have been declining over the last few years. These are data from 2014, and in 2014 we had 2,718 new HIV diagnoses reported to the health department. I'll point out some of the demographic highlights here. Most of the cases you can see, that's the two lines that stand out here, tells you that 80%, over 80% of the cases were among men. The other line that stands out here, but is all the way to the right, is the fact that the 80% of the cases had incomes below the federal poverty line. Other important demographic features to for this group to recognize is that 76% of the HIV cases were among Black and Hispanic individuals. The most common transmission risk was men having sex with men. And I'm going to plow on because I have lots to cover. And the other piece of science that's important to cover is the expanding HIV prevention toolkit. I mean, this, it's not news to this crowd, but certainly post-exposure prophylaxis has been known to us. Pre-exposure prophylaxis is really in the dawn of coming into its own, as well as we also are familiar with viral suppression to decrease HIV infectiousness in terms of the early use of heart and screening and treatment for STD. In New York City, about PrEP, among there was a survey done in 2015 looking at PrEP awareness and use among 620 MSM in New York City, 18 to 40 years, sexually active, and with a self-reported HIV status that was negative or unknown. And what you can see here from this chart is that 83% of the people who were surveyed were aware of PrEP. 15% at the time were on PrEP. What does that tell us? Opportunity. This is New York City's HIV care continuum of the people who are living with HIV. Our continuum of care for 2014 has 72% of New Yorkers with HIV virally suppressed. That's great. That's really great. What does that also tell us? Opportunity. There are 28% who are not virally suppressed. So this is really where the policy piece comes in. In New York State, clearly activism has been able, they have, in the world of HIV, has really been quite successful in resulting in political will. And to that end, the world of activism really did prevail on Governor Cuomo, who in 2014 convened an interdisciplinary task force whose charge was to apply the existing tools to end HIV transmission. And the product of that in 2015 was this blueprint to end AIDS in New York State. There were funds associated with that blueprint, and the state funding was augmented by Mayor Bill de Blasio in December of 2015, on World AIDS Day, no less, to execute a New York City-specific ETE, or Ending the Epidemic Strategy. This also has had funding attached. And so, to this end, funding was brought to bear on ending AIDS and HIV in New York City. It amounted to for the health department alone, it amounted to $23 million per year from the city, $6 million over 5 years from New York State AIDS Institute, which is the Department of Health for New York State. CDC, through a couple of demonstration grants, $3.15 million over 3 years, and the MAC AIDS Fund, $500,000. And the statewide strategies really boil down to this. There are sort of two aspects of the statewide strategies. One addresses HIV-infected persons, get them identified, get them connected to quality care as soon as possible, and keep the viral loads undetectable. And for HIV uninfected persons, the state policy is that all New Yorkers who are at risk for HIV need to be connected to preventive care and access to biomedical interventions, namely PEP and PrEP, to use those with condoms. New York City, of course, customized that plan and came up with its aspirational health department goals, which are to increase access to HIV prevention services, to promote innovative, optimal treatment for HIV, to enhance methods for tracing HIV transmission, and all of this under the umbrella that you heard about on Tuesday from Dr. Mary Bassett, to improve sexual health equity for all New Yorkers. Externally, the funding has been directed to support HIV services of community-based organizations and HIV clinics, as well as coalitions across New York City. And internally, a big piece of the health department funds are being used to enhance and expand STD clinics and HIV services. Very busy slide. We love pillars in New York City. There are five pillars to what we're trying to accomplish. One is, as I've mentioned, the STD clinic enhancements, some HIV case finding and surveillance activities, HIV prevention activities, HIV treatment, and addressing priority populations. You'll notice that under each of these columns, you see a bunch of boxes with more specific activities. The ones that are shaded in yellow are the ones that have to do with the STD clinic activities and enhancements. And this was a pretty ambitious lift, even despite having such an unusual swath of funding coming our way. And so we had to really, considering that World AIDS Day of 2015 was not even a year ago, we had to really jump into gear very quickly. And so the planning and implementation of all of this was really spearheaded through our Deputy Commissioner for the Division of Disease Control at the Health Department, Dr. Jay Varma, who very cleverly decided that we were going to use an incident command approach to getting this off the ground. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the incident command system, it's an alternate organizational structure that organizations jump into when there are acute public health emergencies of either diseases or natural disasters. Some of you may be familiar with the incident command system through your efforts with Ebola or Zika, for example. And what it does is that using this structure assures that we deal with our HIV issue as an emergency. And so what he did was he brought to the table other divisions from within the health department. That included our Division of Finance, our Division of Information Technology, our administrative division in terms of facilities, planning, and human resources and hiring, as well as our External Affairs division, because there would be a lot of public communication as well as our intergovernmental affairs. In addition, of course, he brought in his own disease control bureaus that were relevant to this effort, the Bureau of STD Control, of course, the Bureau of HIV, of course, and our public health labs. And we meet and have been meeting every week to review our process, to review our progress, and to review if we are adequately accounting for this real gift of a policy change. So let me tell you a little bit about the New York City STD clinics. We are there by a mandate of New York State public health law, which requires that every health jurisdiction offer services for STD care. We offer them through the City Health Department to assure that they are accessible. Our services are there available on a walk-in basis, 6 days per week, 2 evenings per week in 8 different locations. Our services are rendered irrespective of ability to pay, irrespective of insurance status, irrespective of immigration status. Our services are confidential, and we will see anyone who's 12 years of age and up without any parental notification. So why the STD clinics? Well, for starters, hopefully this isn't news, STD clinics diagnose a lot of HIV. In New York, not just other STDs. In New York City, for example, these bars represent different disease conditions, And the yellow within the blue bars represents what proportion of those disease conditions were diagnosed in the STD clinics alone across the landscape of New York City. And for HIV, the STD clinics have consistently been the source of 11% of the HIV diagnoses in New York City. And if you look at just acute HIV, which is, those are the hen's teeth of really important transmission cases, the New York City STD clinics have diagnosed about 21% of all acute HIV cases in New York City. That is huge. pun intended. But in addition, we also diagnose an awful lot of STD. Despite all of the providers in New York City, almost a quarter of all PNS syphilis cases are diagnosed in the New York City STD clinics, and almost 20% of the gonorrhea cases are being diagnosed in STD clinics. What does this tell us? One, opportunities for linkage to early and effective treatment, and two, for those who are HIV negative, it means that there is real PrEP possibility because we have a very high-risk population. And in fact, we've gone ahead and documented that. Really some stellar work that was done by Preethi Pathella and others at the health department looked at HIV incidence among STD clinic patients as well as in the city as a whole. What was found was that 1 in 42 HIV negative men who have sex with men who attend the New York City STD clinics were diagnosed with HIV within 1 year of that visit. If we look at primary and secondary syphilis, 1 in 20 HIV negative MSM diagnosed with PNS syphilis are diagnosed with HIV within 1 year of that diagnosis. And 1 in 15 HIV negative MSM diagnosed with anorectal chlamydia and or gonorrhea in the New York City STD clinics were diagnosed with HIV within a year. The data are there. We have the opportunity to introduce PrEP into a population highly needed that could definitely benefit from PrEP. The care that we provide is largely episodic care historically, but let's talk about the people behind the diagnoses. In 2015, the New York City STD clinics had almost 70,800 visits. Two-thirds of those visits were made by men, and 26% of those visits overall were made by specifically men who have sex with men. Over half of our visitors, or patients, I should say, are under 30 years of age. About 75% are black or Hispanic. About 50% in an anonymous waiting room survey that was done a couple of years ago reported that they were uninsured by this anonymous survey methodology. When we started asking questions about insurance, specifically on our medical record, what we learned in 2015 when we did that was that 72% reported no insurance. So let's take a look at what our services are envisioned to be. I'm going to show you a series of slides with the different bundles of services, and I'm going to show you what has existed in 2015 and what we are going to be accomplishing this year and in the next years. For STD services, thanks to ending the epidemic monies, we are able to shore up those services. We are going from a system that included STD evaluations that with provider exams and a very limited capacity to do just screening visits for our patients. We also were providing on-site treatment, vaccines for hepatitis A and B, for meningitis, as well as partner services. Our new services, now that we have ending epidemic funds available, will now include universal access. Anybody who feels they need screening can walk in and get STD HIV screening services. We've also been able to add oropharyngeal NATs to our menu of services, and the anorectal NATs for CT and GC that we've been doing are now being self-collected by our patients. We've added HSV culture for herpes and rapid trick testing, and we've also added vaccine for human papillomavirus. And those have been largely implemented all. Those have been all implemented already. As far as our HIV services, and this is really the centerpiece of ending the epidemic in New York City, We're going from our existing services of offering like a third plus generation rapid HIV test in clinic, as well as pooled acute HIV testing, linkage to care. We'd been using 3-day PEP starter packs and referring for care, providing PrEP referrals and partner services. In 2016, we've already begun. We now have begun offering fourth generation rapid testing in lieu of the prior rapid test. Navigation services, really huge and really important services for our patients who need subsequent care. We are offering, as of this week, full 28-day PEP, post-exposure prophylaxis. In November, we'll be introducing PrEP initiation. In December, immediate ART, and with all of those, laboratory monitoring that goes with that. Our vision really has been to do this on a rather short-term basis, to do the startup and to link to a referral site. But our plan is actually that some proportion of our patients are not going to be able to make that transition right off. And so we plan on being there and able to engage in longer-term relationships than STD clinics have really been doing. So for us, this is a very big paradigm shift, as I imagine such an undertaking would be in any jurisdiction. We're also upgrading our reproductive health and cancer prevention services from just plain old pap smears, emergency contraception, and pregnancy testing to doing quick start full contraception, thin prep pap cytology, anal pap smears, colposcopy, and anoscopy. And we have also added a big piece of social and behavioral health services. Our existing services really were funded through SAMHSA grants of screening and brief intervention with referral to treatment for substance use. This was being done by drug counselors who were assigned to our clinics. Part of ending the epidemic is addressing substance abuse issues. We've hired full FTEs who are social workers and will be full-time employees of the health department. And probably the more exciting piece is that we are doing some STD clinic actual promotion. The first thing that we are doing as far as promoting the use of the STD clinics is we just completed focus groups to find out from patients, what does it feel like to go to an STD clinic? And is that the name of the place that you would want to be going to access the kinds of services that we're talking about here? And what we learned was that people would much rather go to a sexual health clinic or to a clínica de bienestar sexual. And so our clinic names are actually going to be changing to reflect that so that we do make ourselves a more welcoming and respectful setting for people to access our services. We're also trying to enhance the patient experience by enhancing our webpage, making it easier to navigate to directions to our clinics, providing texting services whereupon, actually we're already doing this, you can enter a zip code and you will get the directions to the nearest STD clinic. And it doesn't have to be, it's not just the city clinics, but it's also any nearby low to no cost STD care, HIV care. We are engaged in putting together a patient portal so that although we have an electronic medical record, just like with other kinds of primary care settings, any patient can access their medical chart and their results online. We just installed Wi-Fi in all of our patient waiting rooms, and we will be installing electronic charging stations so that people can charge their electronica. Refurbishing our clinic spaces, and we've just completed a new Welcome to the Clinic video. And importantly, our health commissioner has committed to doing quarterly town hall meetings in each of the very affected areas to talk about what our progress has been in using our ETE funds and taking input from the audience. So the last piece is our evaluation plan. As I said, we review our movement on this plan weekly with this larger group, this cross-cutting health department group. In the longer term, we'll be evaluating outcomes and impacts. And one of the things that we have taken very seriously is our responsibility to disseminate this information, to do the kinds of evaluation that are necessary so that we can help other jurisdictions export our most cost-beneficial and cost-effective successes so that they can be leveraged and adapted elsewhere so that we could really live to see the end of AIDS. As much as I hate losing the meme that STD people do everything from AIDS to Zika, we're going to have to find a B that we work with. I don't know. And so my conclusions are that STD clinic data are key. For those jurisdictions that have those data, look at them. They certainly in New York City, they were compelling, and I would be surprised if they weren't also compelling in other jurisdictions. These are clearly important sites for high-impact HIV prevention and thus can enable the achievement of sexual health and equity across our population. Another conclusion, this is sort of the moving the needle on in terms of changing vision, is that HIV is an STD. I think that in the world of advocacy, that's actually sort of, that is a newer concept than it is to the people who are probably in this room, or who are certainly in this room, hopefully awake. And to use those data to leverage sexual health service integration at the safety net level. And engage the advocates. World of advocacy, again, STDs classically really don't have major advocacy groups. HIV has very well-oiled advocacy groups that have really enabled bold and proactive HIV/AIDS policy, and it was our job to really get onto that radar screen that investment in STD services could really have great benefit for HIV prevention and for the ending of HIV/AIDS. I can say that for the New York City Department of Health's clinical services, in the spirit of Ward Cates, this is our biggest direction yet. And we plan on getting the biggest bang for the most people that we can with this opportunity. The last piece of conclusion is that the data really do need to go to action. Integrating biomedical HIV prevention services with HIV care makes sense. The use of an incident command structure, again, it really does bring HIV prevention into the discussion, the public health discussion, as an emergency. I know Zika's an emergency, I know Legionella's been an emergency in New York City, but HIV still continues to be an emergency in New York City. The use of an incident command structure also cut through bureaucracy very nicely and has maintained a swift pace of measurable change in a circumstance where we have big dollars, big expectations, and very short timelines in which to meet them. And we are also trying to make sure that we are harnessing our data to assure that we are able to evaluate what we do so that other jurisdictions can knowledgeably adapt the most cost-effective pieces of what we do. I'd like to acknowledge the people who helped me put together this presentation, and above all, I'd really like to acknowledge Team ETE in New York City, which, as you've heard, is a cross-disciplinary team. We're lucky enough to have some of these folks here at the conference presenting their really great work, but it has been an amazing, amazing effort by a lot of people. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
So we do have a couple of minutes for questions, if anyone has any for Sue or for any of the speakers.
How close was I to 20?
Oh, yep.
Probably you have a journalist out of New York City, and I'm wondering if 72% of the people you're seeing do not have insurance, and presumably don't have a large income either. How do you handle PrEP, because it's not exactly free? Even if you start them on PrEP, how can they then continue on it without having the money?
New York State has a PrEP app program, and one of the things that our navigators are going to be doing. So first of all, we have purchased medication, so we will get people started. The key is in the navigation and finding out who really does qualify for insurance and getting as many onto insurance or onto PrEP app so that they can continue that preventive service.
Sue, that was phenomenal, and you've really set the bar high on how much change can happen in one health department incredibly quickly. And it's one of the policy lessons seems to be what good leadership will actually do to make that change happen. But I'm wondering, could you tell us, without giving too many quality details, maybe, what made that easier and what made it harder as you did that? Because I think a lot of some health departments are just agog at the thought of, oh, let's create a whole new structure.
Well, what made it easier? Certainly lots of money makes it easier. And I'm not saying that glibly. I mean, that's more than the amount that the health department is putting into the STD clinics is more than what our, like, baseline budget was. So, and that's in, hiring 100 people in a short period of time. What made it easier, like starting with that, has been, again, I think using the incident command structure, saying this is an emergency and we're going to deal with it as an emergency, has been really critical. It's held everyone's feet to the fire, to moving things forward. And like every week, we have to go in there and account for what we've done and what you know, and how close we are to meeting our implementational goals. I think, you know, the piece that hasn't been ideal has been, our evaluation piece, and we've certainly reached out and invited CDC, to opine here, because ideally you have your evaluation plan before you ever start. But we, you know, the timing of things didn't really allow that kind of choreography. What makes things difficult, interestingly, and I will be speaking pretty candidly with this group, is that, you know, I think that, listen, we live in a political world. When things work, everybody gets credit for that. When things don't work, individuals get blamed. And I think that trying to move things forward to get out the pieces of good news, you know, there's a pressure to get out the good news as quickly as possible, but because we have a very large clinic system, 70,000 visits a year, 8 clinics, many of these are undergoing renovations at different levels of intensity. That in itself impacts services, but we have to start small. We always start in one clinic. We don't tend not to do, like, everybody's going to start prep tomorrow. We'll do it in one clinic, get out the kinks, and then roll it out to the other sites. We prefer to advertise that and make noise of that once we're ready in all 8 sites. But the pressure has been, get pills in people's mouths and then put out do some sort of press news about this. And, you know, that makes us in our public health land very uncomfortable to do that before we feel that we're fully cooked, baked. Does that make sense? I hope I didn't offend anybody by saying that.
Can it be quick? Because we are a little bit over. Okay. Thank you.
Fantastic, Sue, and we just want to let you know we're following you, because as we have learned from our treatment guidelines, which is sort of the flagship document from CDC, they're great, but they don't tell people how to implement STD services. So we are drafting and hope to get out within the next year standards for STD clinics, and I think our standards are in line with your clinic. So those of you in the room...
Only our clinics now, though.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So for those of you in the room, need to know the bar is high, but we're going to have a high bar for everybody, because that's what patients deserve, I think, when they... services in STD clinic. One quick question I have for you is, we in STD are nimble, we have limited resources, and we're always willing to stop stuff that isn't working to move on to what needs to work. So I'm wondering, what are you not doing now? Because I can tell you, your job has been probably full-time on this initiative. So what have you taken away, and what's been the consequence of that?
I think we've taken away some of the measured control over our rollouts. I have been around long enough to see several big things roll out across the clinics, and, you know, you like to, you know, we come from scientific and medical backgrounds, which is why we spill coffee. But, we like to make sure something's work. You know, we tend to like to get things absolutely optimized before we, you know, before we call attention to what we do, right? We check our data again and again. We check our processes again and again. But this is really coming out in real time. And so we're not going to have the benefits of closely looking and working out the kinks. What fell by the wayside in terms of what you're asking? Having a fully baked evaluation plan before you're, like, starting to implement. That is pretty, if we were to tell you, we'd like a grant, we're going to do it, we'll evaluate it later, that would never fly. And so that's a challenge. And we want to make sure that we evaluate the hell out of this so that if it does work, I mean, the data are there suggesting that STD clinics really are the place that a lot of good HIV prevention and reproductive health services can be rolled out. to make sure that we are doing it and have evaluated and asked all the right questions so that we can share the information and the experience with others so that they too, in other jurisdictions that don't have the benefit of, you know, a visionary governor and mayor, to really leverage that information to enhance the services that are available in their jurisdictions. And that's what we're not doing. That's, I think, important. And not that we're not doing it, but we're not doing it in the way we would like to be doing it.
So thank you to Sue and to all of our speakers. It was a great session.